they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers. Clearing the Fog is a project of popularresistance.org. You can subscribe to it on Apple, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also find Clearing the Fog at popularresistance.org. And while you're there, you can subscribe to the free Daily Digest. Each morning, you'll receive an email that has summaries of the articles posted the day before. This is a great way to keep up with movement news and analysis. So this week, I interviewed Michael Stephen Smith. Michael Smith is a retired lawyer. He's a former board member from the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he's the co-host of a nationally broadcast radio show, Law and Disorder. And Michael is the author or editor of several books, and his newest book that he co-edited with Zachary Sklar is called From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style. And this book came about partly from the radio show Law and Disorder. At the beginning of 2025, they interviewed several prominent socialists about the state of the United States and what we need to do to solve the many crises that we face and to educate people about what fascism is and how the U.S. is moving in that direction, as well as what we can do to turn things around. He also talks about socialism and how capitalism is not compatible with democracy, but socialism is. So it's a very informative interview, and I hope that you'll stick around for that, as well as checking out his book, From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style. The chapters were written by Chris Hedges, Richard Wolf, Diane Feely, Henry Giroux, Bill Mullen, Margaret Kimberly, and Shama Sawant, and it's available on OR Books. orbooks.com. You can order it there. It's a quick read, just a little over 100 pages. So I hope you'll check it out, because this is a time in the United States when things are moving pretty quickly, and we need to have a good understanding of what's going on, why it's happening the way it is, and what we can do to stop it. Before I get to that interview, I want to talk about some things that are in the news. And of course, I'll begin with Iran, because on Saturday, February 27th, very early in the morning, the United States military, along with Israel, launched an attack on Iran. Now, it looked like this was pretty imminent. On Friday, people were evacuating Israel, and Israelis were told to go to the bomb shelters. So it did seem like, you know, this was going to happen. But still, there was hope that it might not happen, because Oman was helping to host talks, negotiations between the United States and Iran. These have been going on for a little while. And it looked like, actually, Iran was willing to make some significant concessions in its enrichment of uranium and its nuclear energy program. So it looked like this agreement was ready to be signed. And in fact, after the U.S. and Israeli attack on Iran, one of the negotiators, lead negotiators from Oman, said that it looked like the whole deal was ready to be signed. But instead, the United States and Israel launched this attack. Some are postulating that just like back in June, when Israel and the U.S. attacked Iran then in the 12-day war, that was also preceded by negotiations, and the United States used that as a pretext to take Iran off guard, make it seem like there was a process going on and that there would not be an attack, and then surprised Iran with an attack, and that happened again this time, unfortunately. Now, early in the morning of Saturday, President Trump released a pre-recorded 8-minute video announcing that there would be major combat operations in Iran. He said that this was to defend the American people by eliminating imminent threats from the Iranian regime. Now, there were, prior to the attack on Iran, there were no threats to the United States by Iran. The United States has fully, and Israel have fully been the aggressors in this. Iran has been willing to negotiate. And as we know from the process of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, otherwise known as the Iran Nuclear Agreement, that Iran stood by it. It said what it was going to do. It did what it said it was going to do. And it was the United States that dropped out of that agreement. So Iran also turned to the United Nations and prior to Saturday had informed the United Nations of its concerns of being attacked by Israel and the United States. And it did say that according to international law, if Iran is attacked, then it has the legal right to retaliate, to defend itself from those attacks. And what was interesting is that President Trump admitted that he knew that by launching this attack, U.S. soldiers were going to be killed. And of course, we know that many Iranians, hundreds of Iranians, have been killed, and people in other countries in the region have been killed. Of course, Israelis have died as a result of this attack. So this is just the state of the country at this moment as a failing empire that is flailing and trying to hold on to some sort of power and is doing this by launching all sorts of aggressions against other countries. So in that 8-minute video that President Trump pre-recorded and released on Saturday morning, he was calling for the Iranian people to rise up against their government, take it over. He said, quote, "This will probably be your only chance for generations," as if the Iranian people want to take over their government. I think it's important to understand the difference between people in Iran and the Iranian diaspora. Many of the diaspora are people who were supportive of the U.S. puppet, the Shah, who was in power, and would like to see a return to that type of system, which included tremendous wealth inequality. And it was the government of Mossadegh who wanted to use the oil revenues to be able to put in place systems and structures that would support people's basic needs. And that was something that the oil companies just couldn't stomach. So he was overthrown. The Shah was installed. It was a terrible situation when the Shah was in power and he was overthrown in 1979 by the Iranian Revolution. And ever since then, the United States and its Western allies have been aggressive towards Iran, and Iran has withstood that and has been reasonable and measured in its previous responses. But this time, Iran warned, if you attack us again, you will be met with a powerful response. And in fact, within hours of the U.S. attack, Iran launched missiles at Israel, as well as at Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait. In Bahrain and the UAE and Kuwait, the United States was primarily targeting military assets. In Bahrain, they bombed the U.S. 5th Fleet. And in Kuwait, they were also targeting military bases. Interestingly, in United Arab Emirates, the United States targeted the business district. And Dubai is considered this commercial area. There's a lot of business investment there because the laws are favorable to that. And they targeted high-end hotels and malls. One of the hotels was reportedly belonged to President Trump. And then on Saturday, Iran targeted more than 20 military installations and, in countries throughout the region that are allowing the U.S. military to use them to launch its attacks on other countries. Then we learned on Monday that 3 U.S. F-15s were destroyed in Kuwait. What's interesting about this is that the United States was claiming that it was friendly fire, that Kuwait accidentally fired on the F-15s, but Iran is saying that it was responsible for taking those planes down. We don't know at this moment which one is accurate. And then there were also attacks on Saudi Arabia on an oil rig and on a base there. And we don't know who, at this moment, who launched those attacks. There's some concern that it was actually Israel that used this attack on Iran as an opportunity to launch bombs into Saudi Arabia. So they're investigating that. There was also an attack on a U.S. military base in Iraq near Erbil, as well as a munitions depot. So as we expected, the U.S. and Israeli attack on Iran is not going to be limited to Iran. It's igniting the whole region of Western Asia, and China is assisting Iran, Russia as well, in terms of providing with weapons and defense. On Saturday, one of the really egregious actions of U.S. and Israel is that they bombed a school in southern Iran and murdered 185 people in that bombing. More than 150 of them were students. I believe they were between the ages of 8 and 12, and they were girls. We don't know how many U.S. military casualties there are. Iran has said that there are more than 500 people who have died there as a result of the attacks. The U.S. military is reporting 18 deaths of U.S. military members, but analysts are expecting that this is actually going to be much higher because of the attacks on the bases. Also, Iran targeted hotels where U.S. troops were staying because they were evacuated from the bases, moved into hotels. On Saturday morning, in addition to the bombing at the school, the Israel and the U.S. bombed where the Supreme Leader, Sayed Ali Khamenei, who is 86 years old, was. He was reportedly in his office working. In that attack that killed him, it also killed his daughter and his granddaughter, who was 18 months old. Now, I saw reports that the Supreme Leader Khamenei was urged to go to a safer place, but he refused to do that because he said that the nearly 90 million Iranians were not going to be able to go to a safe place. So he didn't feel like he should, you know, have the privilege of doing that. And, you know, Khamenei is someone who came from the revolution. He served as a president. He was someone who was in solidarity with revolutions around the world, in Burkina Faso, Thomas Sankara, in Ireland. And he's portrayed as this kind of dictator, but that's typically what the United States does when it's trying to demonize a country. But he has a long history of being supportive of revolutions around the world. Now, as a result of the attack on Saturday, Iran closed the Strait of Hormuz. This is something that we anticipated would be a consequence of this, and this is already sending the price of oil up. Iran is allowing Chinese and Russian ships to transit that strait, but not other ships. And there was, I think, reportedly 1,200 ships that backed up that were not able to get through. And some of the countries that use that to transport their oil and gas have already decided to stop producing it so that there won't be a backup of that. So this is going to create a bad situation. And I understand there are already people panicking in Asia and long lines at gas stations. Now, Iran has vowed that it will continue attacking Israel and the United States, and it has done this. Iran is arguing that given the aggression of Israel and the United States towards it, and it has been measured in its responses in the past, open to negotiations, but now a line has been crossed, and Iran is going to demonstrate to the world that people should not basically mess with it. Iran started with some of its older and less expensive weapons, and people believe it's doing that to exhaust Israeli defenses. And Iran has been saying that the weapons that they will be using going forward are going to be much more sophisticated and severe. In Israel, they launched attacks in Tel Aviv, blowing up residential buildings there, the intelligence center. They attacked the water desalination plant, which is responsible for a lot of the water supplies in Israel. And this has led to panic in the region and many people, particularly in Israel, trying to get out of the country. I understand that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu left Israel and he was not allowed to land in Cyprus, and so traveled to Berlin in Germany. Now, in addition to Iran, Hezbollah in Lebanon is joining in with Iran in attacking Israel, and they launched attacks into the northern part of the Zionist state. And this is also not a surprise, because Israel has been occupying the southern part of Lebanon and attacking Lebanon over the past couple of years, and of course has a long history of doing that. So Hezbollah has joined in as well, and I understand that some of the military forces in Iraq are also saying that they will support Iran in this. So this is turning into a very serious regional conflict that that could grow. Hopefully it won't. There's also been a lot of retaliation against U.S. embassies in the region. In Lebanon, protesters marched to the U.S. embassy, and in Pakistan, they actually attacked the U.S. embassy with, there were armed demonstrators who attacked the U.S. embassy there. And then on Monday, Iran switched its focus to U.S. naval assets and attacked and destroyed naval bases in the region, as well as a fuel tanker. Spain has told the United States that it must remove its naval ships from the country. I think Spain does not want to be a target. Iran has already targeted Cyprus for housing a naval base there. And I think other countries don't want to be drawn into this conflict. Now, Curry Peterson Smith in These Times has written an article that I think would be a good one for people to read if you have questions about the rationale for this war, because what you're hearing in the corporate media is primarily false. Curry Peterson Smith wrote Five Reasons or Five Realities of the U.S.-Israeli War on Iran. And number one is that this is being sold to people as if Iran is a nuclear threat. Iran actually had a fatwa against nuclear weapons. And in fact, it is Israel and the United States who have nuclear weapons, not Iran. Another point that you're hearing in the media is that the United States had to attack Iran for the Iranian people who want to overthrow their government. And this attack on Iran is not making life any better for Iranians. It's making it much worse. So it's not helping them. We also, the third reality is that the United States is not a reliable negotiator. I talked about that earlier. The fourth is that it's the U.S. that's been threatening Iran, not the other way around. And then the fifth reality is that a war on Iran is highly unpopular in the United States. More than or around 70% of people in the United States do not support a war on Iran. And there were protests across the country on Sunday and Monday. People came out to say hands off of Iran. Now, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers issued a statement, and they say that these attacks are another example of the crime of aggression, that these are a blatant violation of Article 2, parentheses 4 of the United Nations Charter and the principles of sovereignty, territorial integrity of states, good neighborliness, and peaceful settlement of disputes. They say that this clearly violates international law. They also say that neither the United States nor Israel have tried to hide the fact that this is actually about regime change and not any threats to them. And the IADL, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, urges countries around the world to provide assistance consistent with their obligations under international law to Iran, as well as to Palestine and other nations that are subjected to unlawful aggression by the United States and Israel. And they state clearly that Iran has a right to defend itself, and they're calling for all countries to implement an arms embargo on Israel and the U.S., to withdraw their ambassadors and pursue legal actions to hold their military and political officials accountable. I think if you want to get more accurate reports on what is happening in West Asia, Al Mayadeen English is an excellent source. Press TV, The Cradle is another one that I go to, as well as Al Jazeera does some pretty good reporting, although it's become more of a corporate outlet. They do some pretty good reporting. Let's see, other news. The Global Samud Flotilla and the Freedom Flotilla are working together to launch a massive campaign of humanitarian aid to Gaza. They hope to have 200 boats and to leave on April 12th. I have not seen anything yet saying that they're going to delay or cancel that flotilla. They announced this last Thursday, 2 days before the attack on Iran. And this time they're bringing medical personnel and engineers and war crime investigators, as well as humanitarian aid to Gaza. And then it's been now 2 months, as of March 3rd, 2 months since the illegal abduction of Venezuelan President Maduro and the First Lady, Celia Flores. Both of them are being held in prison in the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York. And now we hear that the United States is blocking Venezuela from paying for President Maduro and his wife's legal defense. Their lawyer had filed a request with the Office of Foreign Assets Control in the U.S. Treasury so that they could receive payment for their services, and OFAC blocked that. So President Maduro has filed a statement with the court reporting that this is a violation of his rights. His lawyer has informed the judge that the OFAC is interfering with the president's right to defense. And his next hearing is coming up very soon. It's at the end of this month. Now, there's a large demonstration being planned at the prison on the evening of March 3rd. And that's at 5:30 at 80 West 29th Street in Brooklyn. 80 West 29th Street in Brooklyn. And then a few more items that are in the news. Wondering if Virginia is going to become another Minnesota. ICE has been targeting Virginia, and the Virginia Defender reports that in mid-January, there was a credible report of 180 more ICE agents arriving in Richmond. And there was also news about ICE plans to purchase a 550,000 square foot warehouse in Hanover County to use as a 1,500 bed quote-unquote processing center. And then that they also, ICE wants to build a 10,000 bed detention center in Stafford County, an hour north of Richmond. People are reporting increased sightings of ICE agents in Richmond and northern Chesterfield and Henrico counties. And so there's a lot of concern by folks there. And of course, as you'll remember, when I talked to Colleen Rowley a few weeks ago, she said, you know, ICE now has more than doubled the number of agents, and they're going to have to use those agents. So they're going to be deployed around the country, and Virginia may come next. Fortunately, folks there are mobilizing and organizing, and the state is taking steps to end cooperation between local law enforcement and ICE. Some good news coming out of Chattanooga, Tennessee. Volkswagen workers voted to ratify their first union contract. The Volkswagen workers there joined United Auto Workers in 2024, and this is the first contract coming out of that unionization. They are all going to immediately get a $6,550 bonus, and they'll also receive a 20% wage increase across the life of the contract, which goes until 2030. Their healthcare premiums will be reduced by 20% and won't go up for 4 years, and they have a cost of living adjustment, as well as they're getting 2 additional days off and then some other job security benefits. So congratulations, you fought hard for this and you won. In Oregon, a new coalition formed of Oregon unions who are going to advocate for a transition to clean energy. And they have a plan to do that. They've been working with the Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations to put together a plan on how to do this green transition. They call themselves Climate Jobs Oregon. And this is happening in other states as well: Colorado, Illinois, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Texas, and Washington State have all formed these climate jobs coalitions of workers, and this is a direction that we need to go. The government is not doing this, so it comes down to the people and the workers to organize and make this happen. And then just one thing I wanted to let you know about, you may remember about a year ago, there was a passenger plane that was hit by a military helicopter when it was landing at the airport in Washington, D.C. And so there was a big uprising about how to increase airline safety, and a bill was introduced called the Rotor Act that would demand that all aircraft have anti-collision technology installed. And this was supported by the unions, it was supported by the FAA, and it passed in the Senate in December. And then the military stepped in and pressured the House, and so they failed to pass it when they voted on this on February 24th. So this legislation has not passed. And unfortunately, there's another bill that's been introduced in Congress called the ALERT Act. And so Congress members are saying, well, it's okay that we didn't pass the Rotor Act because we can pass the ALERT Act. But what you need to know is that the ALERT Act does not include a requirement that all aircraft have anti-collision technology. So we need to speak out and demand that our air travel is safe. Anyway, I think I'll stop there. We'll take a short musical break and come back with the interview with Michael Smith.
Calm your masters of war. You that build all the guns. You that build the death plane. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind desks. I just want you to know we can see through your mask. You that never done nothing but build the destroy. Oh, you play with our world like it was your little toy. You put a gun in our hands, then you hide from our eyes. Then you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly.
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed with Margaret Flowers. And now I turn to my guest, Michael Stephen Smith. Michael is an attorney, a former board member at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the co-host of the nationally broadcast radio show Law and Disorder. He's also the author, editor, and co-editor of many books. His newest book, From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style, he co-edited with Zachary Sklar. Michael, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
Well, it's a pleasure, Margaret. I follow popular resistance every day. I get it at 6 o'clock in the morning on my iPhone. It's one of the first things I read every day. So it's a pleasure to speak with you. I just want to say I'm a retired attorney, and hopefully I won't be getting any requests for work because I've got enough on my hands, particularly now.
Right. Yes, absolutely. With so much going on. And that brings us to this book. It was published in 2025, and I understand that it came out of your radio program, Law and Disorder. Can you talk about your program and how this book came together?
Sure. Law and Disorder started 21 years ago. The first station that we were on was WBAI. We were on every other week, and then we were on every week. And now we're on 200 stations across the country.
Wow.
Last month, we had statistics came in. We had almost a million visitors to our show. And we also broadcast terrestrially. We had 565,000 listeners every week. So we've gone from WBAI, which is our mother station, we're still on it 11 o'clock Monday morning, to 200 stations from Woodstock to San Diego. We just picked up Fairbanks, Alaska, and Kansas City, Missouri. We started off with Michael Ratner, who was then the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He passed away some years ago. And Heidi Boghossian, who's still with us, Heidi was the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. And me, and Dahlia Hashad, who was working at Amnesty International. And now we've changed personnel somewhat. Heidi and I still do the show, and we've been aided by three attorneys from California, Maria Hall from Los Angeles. She's a trial attorney, civil rights attorney. Jim Lafferty, who's a former director of the National Lawyers Guild. And up in Northern California, Steve Rohde, who's a retired civil liberties lawyer. So we have five lawyers doing this show.
And what do you focus on?
Came out of the show. Well, the show is really an intellectual history on the left for the last 21 years. We've had guests from Tariq Ali to Howard Zinn. And we focus on law and politics.
Great. And can you talk about how the book came from that program?
Sure. Well, the inspiration of the book came from writings that Leon Trotsky did in the 30s called Fascism, What It Is and How to Fight It. And my thinking was we should do an update on that kind of analysis and program. We were inspired by the great author and political figure, Bertolt Brecht, who said in order to understand fascism, you really have to understand capitalism from which it springs. And based on that, we did seven interviews with seven prominent socialists in the country. Chris Hedges, who's a journalist and really a moral philosopher. Richard Wolff, the most prominent Marxist economist in the country. Diane Feeley, who's a leader in the group Solidarity, a socialist feminist organization, and the editor of the magazine Against the Current. Henry Giroux, who's an expert on democratic education. He's a professor in Canada. Bill Mullen, who's recently written a book on fascism and how black people have always been in the vanguard of fighting fascism. Margaret Kimberly, who is the editor of Black Agenda Report. And last, the seventh author, is Shama Sawant, who is currently running for Congress out of the state of Washington as a socialist. And she's educating people about the necessity, if we're going to stop this fascist growth, the necessity of a general strike. We're not there yet, but we've taken some steps towards that.
Right, right.
So those are the people that are in the book. And you wanted to ask me about fascism.
Yeah, I did. Thank you. Because it seems like more and more people are talking about fascism, organizing against it. I see, you know, in Venezuela, they put together an anti-fascist social movement coalition that's global. The Italians, when they were organizing their strike in early February to shut down the ports to stop weapons flows, talked about how this was really about global fascism and the need for unions to come together and fight fascism. Can you describe for the listeners, what is fascism? And you mentioned capitalism. Let's talk about how it's connected to that as well.
Certainly. You know, I'm thinking about this and I wrote out, so I won't miss any points, I wrote out a very short definition of fascism. I'd like to read that and then elaborate on some of the central points of fascism. Fascism has been defined as an ultra-nationalist and authoritarian political philosophy characterized by dictatorial leaders, a strong central government, militarism, the forceful suppression of opposition, a belief in natural social hierarchy, racism, and the subordination of individual interests to the perceived interests of the nation. And it rejects liberal democratic principles. Fascism is racist, homophobic, misogynistic. It makes use of scapegoats. And by this definition, the United States is on its way to becoming a fascist nation. I wanted to elaborate on some of the points I just made. It's characterized by a strong dictatorial leader, and certainly Trump is that. I'll talk about Trump in a moment, but I think that Trump's even own musing saying that he desired to be a dictator. Strong government, militarism. We don't need any more proof of militarism than the attack on Iran yesterday. And 2 weeks before that, the kidnapping and attack on Venezuela. The forceful suppression of opposition, we're coming to that. They're building detention centers around the country. ICE has just ordered more weapons, not just pistols, but long rifles. Racism, and what better example could you have than J.D. Vance accusing Haitians, black people, of eating pets, eating cats and dogs. A rejection of liberal democratic principles. They've overturned the system of checks and balances pretty much in the United States. America established a separation of powers. There's the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive, and they balance each other off. Well, now Trump has taken issuing executive orders, bypassing the legislature and ignoring the courts. Even when they rule against him, he just ignores the rulings and misogynistic. I mean, what more do you need than Trump's boasting of what he could do to women and is being convicted of abusing a woman in the showroom? And I think it was Bloomingdale's or Bergdorf Goodman. Is having an affair openly and without any punishment, really, with Stormy Daniels. The guy, quite obviously, is not a friend of women. That's coming out more and more now with the Epstein files. I think we're going to see a lot more disclosures about what he's done, particularly with young girls. So that's my answer to your question about how would I define fascism.
Right. And what is the connection between fascism and capitalism?
I think capitalism and fascism are compatible. I think that democracy and capitalism are incompatible. Democracy and socialism are compatible, but not democracy and capitalism. And that's because of the very nature of capitalism. It seeks to empower a certain group of people who have more wealth and more income than the rest. So it's a totally unequal situation to begin with. In the United States, you have 3 billionaires holding the wealth of about half of the rest of the country. 3 billionaires. You can't have democracy when you have, like you have in the United States, 1,140 billionaires. Trump's friend Elon Musk himself contributed in the last election cycle $330 million to the election. You can't have a democracy when finances are skewed in that direction. You have a ruling by the Supreme Court which says that a person can give any amount of money they want, and a corporation can give any amount of money they want to a political party. And that's the root of the imbalance of power, that these huge conglomerations of capital control the political system. I think that's quite evident now.
Absolutely. And I think it's been proven through several academic studies as well. So Gabriel Rockhill, my understanding of how he talks about fascism is that capitalism tends towards fascism, that if the capitalists are able to do what they want to do under a quote unquote liberal democracy, they will do that. If they can, you know, fool the people and convince the people to go along with their agenda, they'll do that. But once the people start fighting back, he says that's when you really start to see the more authoritarian and repressive arm of the state. This has been kind of a long process. Would you agree that the United States has been tending in this direction for a while? And how do you feel, you know, President Trump is in moving us on that path to outright fascism?
I certainly would agree. I think that there's always been a tendency towards racism and fascist organization going all the way back in American history, even before the Civil War, after the Civil War with the Reconstruction, even during the 1930s when there was a big radicalization, there were fascist elements in this country. And especially now, I think the project of both the Democratic and Republican parties for the last 50 years has been to destroy the social gains that were won by the radicalization in the 30s. And I think within that is the seeds of fascism. And we've seen that blossoming. I wanted to talk about Trump, because I think the answer to the question, is Trump a fascist? I think the answer is no. And I think so for the following reasons. I think Trump is more of a cult figure with really no politics. The rise of Donald Trump and his MAGA supporters has transformed American politics perhaps more than anything has since the gathering of forces of the rebellious slave owners in the South a century and a half ago. It's a sobering thought to reflect on the fact that Trump received 74 million votes in 2020 and 76 million votes in 2024. Trump himself is a hollow man, devoid of any feelings of human solidarity. Pragmatically, he stands for nothing but his own self-aggrandizement. He's a product of his connections to the Mafia, City Hall, and the tabloid yellow sleaze media like Fox News. When she divorced him, his first wife, Ivanka, said that he kept a copy of Hitler's speeches at his bedside. An allegation in her complaint was that he raped her. As a businessman, he was a con artist and a cheat. His first 4 years in office were chaotic, uninformed, and not animated by any kind of cadre capable of administrating the state. Predictably, this has changed. He now has the aid of the Right Wing Heritage Foundation, which has produced Project 2025, a 900-page plus document on how to change our country. He has the financial support of several billionaires like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk. He has an authoritarian right-wing Supreme Court, which in its latest decision, aptly named Trump versus the United States of America, has given the presidency carte blanche immunity and placed it above the law, allowing the president to do anything he wants as long as, quote, an official act. Although ignorant and quite obviously mean-spirited, Trump is an extremely effective orator, as was Hitler. He has an extensive following and makes money for the networks who give him all the time he wants on the basis that, quote, it might not be good for America, but it's good for CBS, in the infamous quote by Leslie Moonves, the former head of CBS. Consequently, millions of followers are ignorant and support Trump, regardless of the harm he'll do them. Denial of man-made climate change is already leading to human extinction. So that's my evaluation of Trump. I think Trump is more of a cult figure than a political leader, in a sense that people have kind of a blind allegiance to him, a veneration. And it's not because of his politics. He really doesn't have politics. The people around him have politics. Stephen Miller, I think you could really define as a fascist. What's his name? The head of the Defense Department. Now the Department
Peter,
of War.
Yeah, Peter Hegseth.
Hegseth is another. And his Homeland Security person, Noam, the woman who murdered her puppy,
right,
is another. You know, these people are mean-spirited. They lack any kind of human empathy. I remember a quote from Hannah Arendt saying that the death of human empathy is one of the earliest and most telling signs of a culture about to fall into barbarism. And I think that that's what our culture is about to do. It's about to fall into barbarism.
Yeah, and I think Chris
You're
Hedges.
Probably wondering, I'm sorry, what did you say?
I was going to say Chris Hedges has written about the same thing, about how when you see a society that's failing, how these elements come out that you described. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just thinking of the flag and the cross, fascism American style. The flag of the cross is the title of our book. And we title that because almost every politician, Republican and Democrat, wear that flag pin in their suit lapels. They mostly wear, Trump especially, wears a red tie, a white shirt, and a blue suit. And the cross, Trump's press secretary, Leavitt, what's her first name?
I think it's Karen.
Caroline Leavitt. Caroline Leavitt wears that gold cross quite conspicuously around her neck when she holds a press conference. John Stewart made fun of her. He calls it a Pinocchio cross. And every time she tells a lie, the cross grows and grows. The last show he was on, he had a huge cross almost bearing her down to the ground that she wore around her neck. The flag and the cross, those are the symbols that American fascism has adopted.
Right. That reminds me of the U.S.-backed coup in Bolivia when Jeanine Añez came to power. And she began with a huge Bible. It was like a just gigantic Bible that she stood behind and used that as a symbol of her fascistic administration. So under the second term of President Trump, he has been moving quickly to expand the apparatus of the repressive state. So he has more than doubled the number of ICE agents. I spoke with Colleen Rowley recently, and she talked about how they had really lowered the standards of who they were hiring for these ICE agents. They're giving billions of dollars to ICE. They've, I think, more than doubled the budget. They're spending $38 billion to build detention centers across the United States in communities far from the borders. Would you say that this administration is accelerating putting the infrastructure into place to have a repressive state? Where do you see this going right now?
I think what you said is precisely true. And the acceleration has come at an alarming pace. The building of these concentration camps, really, in every corner of the country is scary. The fact that ICE is buying weapons, not just pistols, is scary. They're recruiting thugs. They recruit these guys at places like gun shows, or books, who published our book as a book coming out on who these people are. A lot of them are veterans of the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. This is Trump's version of Hitler's brown shirts.
Right.
And they're out there not to arrest illegal immigrants. They're out there to terrorize the country. We certainly saw that in Minneapolis.
Absolutely. And you mentioned how Trump has been using executive orders, and he seems to be using those to expand the scope of who the agents can detain. So they can detain people who are here in the country legally. And they're doing this new process to scrutinize people who have green cards and try to find reasons to detain them, deport them. So you mentioned, you know, the Supreme Court and how the United States is supposed to have a system of checks and balances. We know that that's been weakening for decades. The power of the executive office has been growing. Now Trump has just launched an attack on Iran on Saturday, February 27th. We know the news has come out that Iran had made significant concessions, that the U.S. and Iran, the negotiators, were close to an agreement. Iran filed with the United Nations, letting it know that if the United States attacks it, it will target U.S. military bases. Even Trump himself said U.S. military members are going to be killed in this attack. But he went ahead and launched the attack without permission. How would you assess the current level of power of this administration? And is it something that we can rein in?
Not right now. The relationship of forces is geared heavily towards the Trump people. But we have the numbers. Never forget that. We have the numbers, and we have the power to withhold our labor. If workers in this country don't work and go on strike, it closes down the economy. That's our ultimate power, and that's ultimately what we have to develop. I thought we made a good start in Minneapolis. They didn't have a general strike, but people didn't go to work. They didn't go to school. They didn't shop. And what we need to do is get more people behind that, more of the trade unions behind that, and have a general strike. The author of the last chapter in our book, From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism in American Style, Kwame Sawant, is running for Congress in the state of Washington, and she's using her congressional campaign to publicize the idea of a general strike. When we first interviewed Chris Hedges 5 months ago for his chapter in our book, he talked about a general strike. It seemed far-fetched then. It's not so far-fetched now. People are actually talking about it. And I wanted to just elaborate on a point that you made earlier, Margaret, about the repressive apparatus growing. On September 29, Trump issued National Security Presidential Memorandum Number 7. And that was supplemented by a memorandum by his Attorney General, Pam Bondi. What Trump's memorandum laid out was that people who think like us, people who listen to our shows, are the enemy. We're against capitalism. We're against this fundamentalist Christian fascist religion. We're against racism. We're against homophobia and so on. Militarism, racism. And those are the people he's targeting. And Pam Bondi, in a supplemental security memorandum, listed some 20 laws that could be used against us. They can find us. They've got AI. They can find us. They can arrest us. They can put us in these concentration camps. And it doesn't sound to me like a fable to say that this is ultimately a real concern that people should understand. This is the direction that this country is going in. I don't want to sound alarmist because we're not there yet, but this is the direction that Trump is taking us.
Right. And it's not outside the scope of possibility. If you look at the history of the United States, I think about Korea in the middle of the last century, when, you know, they went after the leftists there, murdered, you know, I don't even know, I think hundreds of thousands of leftists there. I think, you know, that there's been a long war by the capitalists and the elites against the left and against people who believe in socialism. So it wouldn't be unprecedented for the United States to do this. And I also think about the European Union and how it's already sanctioning people who are media people who provide a narrative that goes against the power structure. They're being completely cut off. You know, Jake Bo, there's Dugru Hossein, who's a German citizen. They can't use their bank accounts. People can't even buy things for them. They're so heavily sanctioned. They can't travel. They can't afford their legal defense. So this attack is happening now, and it's a real entity.
Absolutely. The attack has been going on ever since the Palmer Raids after the First World War, when they imprisoned and deported thousands of radicals and socialists. It happened during the McCarthy period, when they destroyed the Communist Party. It happened in 1947, when they destroyed radicals in the unions. And it's occurring now. And they're going to start trying to pick us off, I'm afraid. What we need is more programs like yours, Margaret, more education, more organizing. I thought that the Minneapolis situation was terrific in right. that respect, with the community coming together when an ICE mob congregated anywhere. People were out there blowing whistles with alarm. They were taking photographs of what was going on. They were meeting beforehand in bookstores to decide what to do. This kind of thing is happening also in New York City, in Sunset Park, near where I live. People are meeting and organizing against a possible FAT invasion by ICE. I thought that the Mamdani campaign is a step in the right direction. He had 90,000 people out there knocking on doors, tabling, trying to get him elected. He didn't run as a Democrat in this. He ran as a Democratic Socialist, which is different. And the people that he got out there supporting him, they got to keep being mobilized. I think that would be a good defense. If Trump plans to send his ICE people back into New York, I think there's going to be a tremendous fight here in New York. And I think Mamdani had said, I was elected as a Democratic Socialist. I'm going to govern as a Democratic Socialist. He told Cuomo, he said, Cuomo, he said, I may be young, but I have integrity, which is something you don't have. Mm. And he's so far shown that he has integrity. So I'm hoping that he'll be consistent in a mouthpiece for our movement to fight any kind of attempt by Trump to bulldoze people here in New York City.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, there's that hope. It's a very tough battle to be able to work within that political system. I am disappointed that he hasn't done anything to take action against the imprisonment of President Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, in New York. I understand that the mayor of New York could withdraw institutional support for that imprisonment and there are other things that he could be doing. But that aside, you mentioned, you know, we live in a country that is ruled by two major parties. They're both corporate-backed parties who have a lot of similarities. What is your analysis of the current Democratic Party in the face of the threats that we have and now this new war, which is really escalating in the West Asian region?
The Democratic Party is the other capitalist party. They started out dismantling the no deal with Clinton and his globalization back 50 years ago when he facilitated the loss of 30 million American jobs. This was facilitated by Clinton and has continued on. They're trying to dismantle the New Deal. And it's been a 50-year effort by them. The Democratic Party is a capitalist party. You saw it at the State of the Union message that Trump gave. You had the Democrats popping up and applauding when he was talking about attacking Iran. You have them now totally supporting the attack on Iran. You don't see them mobilizing against the kidnapping of Maduro. The Democratic Party is our enemy. We can't have any faith in them. Yes, I know there are some decent Democrats. That's true. There are some decent judges. That's true. But overall, they're a reflection of the whole capitalist system. And what we need is our own independent political organization. That's what Malcolm X taught us, and that's what we need to do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there may be good people, but they're operating within a system that is very powerful and goes against those interests. We've seen, you know, like what happened to Denis Kucinich when he was the holdout against Obama's health legislation, and then they redistricted and knocked him out of office the next election. So you talked about what's happening in Minneapolis and around the country, and I think that's important to highlight because the folks in Minneapolis have been organizing for quite a while. Of course, the murder of George Floyd was a big part of that. Other communities, I know you mentioned New York, I know here in Baltimore where I live, folks are already organizing. So it's really important for listeners to understand that in order to be prepared, we have to start organizing now or build off the organizing that we've done. We need to take the country in another direction. And there is a growing interest in socialism. And as you talked about, you know, socialism and democracy are compatible. Can you talk a little bit more for the listeners about what socialism would look like and whether that is the path we should be focused on?
Well, a few years ago, I edited a book along with my wife, Debbie Smith, and the great Francis Golden, the literary agent. I edited a book called Imagine Living in a Socialist America. Imagine Living in a Socialist America. The book was unfortunately ahead of its time. A year after the book came out, Bernie Sanders popularized the notion of socialism. And we asked HarperCollins, the publisher, to republish the book, but they wouldn't do it, of course. HarperCollins is owned by Murdoch.
Right.
But at that time, and increasingly now, a majority of young people were in favor of socialism. And that's even more true now. That's because young people have no hopes. They have no future in this country. They can't get a decent job anymore. They can't make enough money to buy a house. They can't make enough money to have a family and have children. They're really at a dead end, and they know that. And so when you ask them about socialism, they're in favor of it. And I think that we need to educate more and more people about what socialism is. Socialism is actually democracy. It's economic democracy. It's workers' control of the economic system. And it's the most democratic system that we've known of. And we have to educate people about that.
Absolutely. And of course, folks in the United States who want to learn more, it's easy to travel to Latin American nations where they're putting in place socialist systems and to learn firsthand about how they're doing that and how that's benefited them. And it's important to find these opportunities to travel there. So let's finish by talking about where can people find your book and where can they follow the work that you do?
Well, the name of my book is called From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style. It's 100 pages. It's almost a pamphlet. It's a handbook for what's going on, what we can do about it. And it can be ordered. Don't order it from Amazon. Get it from OR Books directly. OrBooks.com. O-R-B-O-O-K-S. OrBooks.com. And that way, you can get the book, read it. You can read it in a couple of hours, and you'll understand, I think, more profoundly because of the people that contributed 7 chapters of this book. You'll understand more profoundly what fascism is, what socialism is, and how we get there.
Wonderful. Do you have any final words for the listeners?
I think that what we need to do is organize, organize, and organize. That's what the IWW did 100 years ago. That's what we got to do now. We got to be out there like they did in Minneapolis, talking to everybody. We got to be out there talking to people like they're doing here in New York City. And we've got to organize and organize and organize. That's my final word, Margaret. I truly appreciate being on your program.
Well, Michael, thank you so much. I really appreciate your program. I hope people will check that out on WBAI, Law and Disorder, or you can find it on 200 stations across the United States. And thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
You're very welcome. You take it easy, Margaret.
You've been listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed. I'm Margaret Flowers. My guest today was Michael Smith. I'll go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want.
We'll lift our brothers and our sisters. We'll lift the people together. Can